Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Mitchell Prothero, covering the Syria war for McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Welcome to the show, Mitchell. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me tonight.
I really appreciate you joining us. And I guess you're in Beirut, and it's right around dinner time there, so I especially appreciate you taking time out to do the show today.
Oh, no problem. It's turned into kind of a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day job covering Lebanon and Syria these days, so we're ready for it.
Right. Well, let's hope nothing newsworthy happens during the interview. All right. In fact, so let's start with that. There have been bombings in Libya, and the war in Syria is spreading to Libya. Is that right? Who's bombing who, and what's been the responses so far?
Well, for a little bit of history, I mean, the country of Lebanon's only existed for about 50 years. And prior to that, it had always historically been part of what they call Greater Syria, which today is mostly the country of Syria. So the ties between these two countries are incredibly close. Syria occupied Lebanon for nearly 28 years, I think, maybe 27, only leaving in 2005 did their military go. So what we've been seeing is a lot of the problems that Lebanon has historically had between religious communities, in this case Sunni and Shia Muslims, it's spread here from Syria as their civil war has grown increasingly sectarian. You've got a country of about 80% Sunni Muslims who've had it with the regime that's backed by Iran and a religious minority there that's very close to them. So it's turning into a difficult situation here.
And now one of the recent attacks was by one or the other al-Qaeda groups, and I guess we'll have to get into that, but it was against Hezbollah there in southern Lebanon, or in a Hezbollah-controlled neighborhood in Beirut. Is that right?
Well, we've had a number of these situations, and what we're finding is, despite Hezbollah's reputation in the United States for being a terrorist organization going back to the 80s, and certainly they've been responsible for attacks against the United States and Israel for decades, although I will point out they haven't done anything towards the United States since the 80s when U.S. troops were here in Lebanon. Hezbollah, being Shia Muslims, are fundamentally representing a group of people who are deeply oppressed by anybody with sort of a Sunni Muslim, what we call al-Qaeda mentality, the jihadi Salafist. They believe that anybody who isn't a Muslim in the exact traditional way like they are is in fact worse than an infidel and needs to be killed. So what you face is a community here that's fought against the West and Israel for 30-something years, coming under attack by fellow Arabs, fellow Muslims, who believe that their version of Islam is literally apostate. So as they've defended the Syrian regime to try to keep these guys out of here, Hezbollah and Syria, the Syrian president, are very close allies, have been for a long time. They've sent troops to help keep him in power. You're seeing these groups, which are also fighting the regime in Damascus, attacking guys here in Lebanon. So Hezbollah is in a very similar situation to America or Israel, where they have Muslim terrorists trying to set off car bombs in their areas. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess Hezbollah has done some operations inside Syria on behalf of the government. And then are these bombings, you think, meant to draw them in further and try to spread this war around, or maybe erase that European drawn border there?
Well, here, in a way, quite the opposite. First off, the al-Qaeda guys, in their mentality, this is all part of a historic area. So fundamentally to them, they don't recognize the government of Lebanon, and they don't recognize the government of Syria. They'd only recognize an Islamic caliphate. So they don't care, you know, in terms of ideology, where they're going to attack Hezbollah. But Hezbollah, yes, it's not even doing operations. For the first time in the organization's 30-plus year history, they're openly engaging in a military conflict against fellow Arabs, and doing it more or less more openly than I've ever seen them do anything in the 10 years I've lived in Lebanon. They're defending it politically. They've got, you know, anywhere from hundreds to thousands of troops inside Syria. And many of us think that it's been the role of Hezbollah's very experienced, very professional fighters that has probably kept the Assad regime alive. So if you're fighting the Assad regime, starting trouble in Lebanon might draw some of those guys back home for security and thus reduce the number of people you're facing on the battlefield in Syria. I think that's the mentality that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, so when we talk about the Nusra Front and the Islamic Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham and all of these things, who's who, and how can you tell a different Al-Qaeda from one from another?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had a discussion with my editor about this the other day where he said, you know, ideologically, most of these groups are Al-Qaeda and probably aren't going to be very friendly to the West. And I told him he was absolutely right. The problem is they see fundamental differences amongst themselves. And in the case of most of the Syrian groups, they're currently fighting a predominantly foreign group of what we would call Al-Qaeda fighters and previously. But today we can't even call them that because Al-Qaeda has said, these guys are psychos. We don't want anything to do with them, which is something that I reported about today from McClatchy. There's actually a letter from a member of Al-Qaeda who's fighting in Syria where he said, you know, you're not Al-Qaeda, I'm Al-Qaeda. I knew bin Laden. You people are crazy. Mm-hmm. Your crimes are against Muslims and all this stuff.
Well, now
so you're looking at is a group called, so the main group that you're looking at in this case is what they call the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, or ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. These guys were formed by veterans fighting against the United States during the occupation of Iraq. They're filled with foreign fighters, and they had come into Iraq or come into Syria to support the rebellion initially, but what they started doing was setting up their own Islamic State. And most of them are foreign, so even if you're a very conservative Syrian, like you might see in groups like the Nusra Front, Ahrar al-Sham, the Islamic Front, and these groups have a lot of ideological basis with al-Qaeda, they saw foreigners coming in and pushing a new version of Islam on them, and as a result, they're all fighting.
Right, and so now, back in October, it was ISIS and Nusra were both declaring loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, hiding in somebody's mother's basement in Pakistan, somewhere, I guess, still.
Right.
But then they had a fight over who was more loyal to him or who was in the chain of command. Is that where this real split took place between the Nusra and the ISIS?
It's been actually more local politics. I had a Nusra commander tell me flat out, look, fundamentally, we do agree with these guys. It's just this is about politics, and politics is just as important in jihad as fighting is. That was his explanation. But what you saw was a predominantly Syrian group that, you know, the Nusra Front, that was very effective and continues to be on the battlefield, has done some suicide attacks, but has also been very careful not to irritate Syrian people. When they come in, they do anti-corruption measures. They're not implementing a difficult version of Islamic law in their areas for the most part. Mm-hmm. They're treating people with respect and fighting very hard against the regime. On the other hand, you had this group, ISIS, which were predominantly foreign and were trying to force sort of an alien version of Islam on the Syrian people. As a result, Al-Qaeda actually got involved trying to, you know, negotiate a settlement between these two groups, both of which agree with them. And what they concluded was that Nusra is the proper Al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. Everybody in ISIS should join it or leave. And they rejected that advice. So it's the first time in, you know, the 10 years I've been covering this stuff that we've seen a dispute between these groups break out into public.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a lot like what happened in Iraq, right, where the Al-Qaeda guys were going around conscripting fighting-age males and punishing people in different ways for smoking cigarettes and vices and these kinds of things where, like you're saying, they're not even from there, and they wore out their welcome real quick, and that's happening here. But then, so what's the relative power between ISIS and Nusra? Because even though Nusra's from there, one of your articles here is about ISIS fighting back and executing scores of rivals and making some pretty severe gains against Nusra recently.
Well, what it is it's sort of a way that Syria is laid out. And remember, Nusra's not alone. They've got, you know, groups that you'd consider more moderate Islamic groups or even secular called the Syrian Revolutionary Front, which are remnants of the Free Syrian Army that the West had backed. Members of Ahrar al-Sham, who are deeply conservative, but have said that they do not want anything to do with this jihad stuff. they're simply here to fight the regime, and then Nusra. So ISIS is really quite overwhelmed in terms of numbers. But what you're seeing them able to do, because they basically have a lot of experience moving around in the desert between Iraq and Syria. This is where they were formed. You can actually see on a map a corridor between Fallujah and the town of Raqqa. This is all ISIS's turf. It's very empty, and they've come equipped with a lot. I know this is going to sound funny, but the sheer number of pickup trucks that they have means that they can move around the fighters that they do have relatively quickly. So they've been able to hold their desert areas, but for the most part, they're getting kicked out of the rest of rebel-held Syria in the north and in the west.
Mm. All right, and now, so where exactly did this Islamic Front come from? How large is that? Is that just a new name for the FSA, or that's something altogether that's no
quite Swiss the group? Opposite, actually. Well, the FSA had basically collapsed in and on itself for a lot of different reasons. The West didn't back them. They sort of lacked popular support, except in the very beginning, but a lot of them had turned to banditry. They were robbing people and sort of acting like a mafia, or they weren't just fighting very hard. So they sort of collapsed. What you saw then is they fell apart were groups that were religiously motivated as the conflict became more Sunni versus Shia. And these groups that hadn't been part of Nusra or ISIS, they're not al-Qaeda by any means, but they are deeply religious guys. I'd compare them to American fundamentalist Christians. They're deeply religious. You know, they get money from outside the country, from mosques and collections. And, you know, they're farm boys to a large extent. And these guys have formed, their units all decided that the rebels needed to be under one command and all agreed to form what we're calling now the Islamic Front. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's four main groups. The Islamic Front, which is quite large, probably the largest single fighting force in the country right now. The remnants of the Free Syrian Army, and then Nusra and what we're calling ISIS.
Mm-hmm. And then the Saudis are sending most of their money toward the new Islamic Front, is that right?
Well, we're having a hard time telling exactly what the Saudis are doing. There's a lot of internal politics with the Americans over Iraq. So, and also Saudi, a lot of their money comes from unofficial sources. The mosques collect a tremendous amount of money throughout the Persian Gulf. You see it in Kuwait, Qatar, UAE, and KSA, as we call Saudi Arabia. So, you know, some of it is going to whatever groups they've been funding for a while. But yes, of course, the Saudis, just like the Qataris and UAE, all of them are Kuwaitis, are going to generally back a pretty austere fundamentalist group because that's how their countries are run. So their money has gone to things like the Islamic Front, Ahrar al-Sham, and Nusra to a large extent.
All right. Now, can you hold through this break and do another segment with us here, Mitchell?
Sure, I can do one more.
Okay, great. Everybody, it's Mitchell Prothero writing for McClatchyDC.com, McClatchy Newspapers. He's in Beirut, and we're talking about the civil war in Syria and spreading Iraq and Lebanon and on. We'll be right back after this.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Mitchell Prothero, covering the Syrian war for McClatchy Newspapers at McClatchyDC.com. And we're talking about who's who. Sure is hard to keep track. That thing going on over there. And now
I spend all day on it, and it's not easy.
I'm sorry. Yeah, oh, I bet. I know. I can tell by reading all the guys, even, you know, talking with Patrick Coburn and the best experts in the world. They go, well, you know, the lines between who's who and who claims what, it's pretty hard to tell sometimes. But I guess Patrick emphasizes the bloodthirst on the part of these jihadists for killing Shiites indiscriminately. That's all. They just wake up in the morning wanting to kill Shiites, apparently, without even much thought to strategy or anything else.
Well, I mean, I don't know that they don't use strategy for it, but yeah, a true fundamentalist Sunni has a very serious, serious problem with Shia Islam. And it's over very small stuff that, you know, a not even non-expert, somebody outside of the community could barely tell the difference between the two. But again, it's about a fight 1,500 years ago for control of the direction of the religion. And,
right.
You know, certainly both sides haven't quite let it go yet.
Well, so which of the jihadists are the moderates that we can work with? Can we get this Islamic front to show up in Geneva and negotiate?
Well, ask yourself, if you're the Islamic front, why would you bother?
I don't know. Obama already said that Assad must go, right?
Well, he did, but then he didn't do anything to help. So in terms of credibility, right now you see...
Well, now, come on, Mitchell. Isn't the Saudi operation an American operation there? Isn't the CIA coordinating all of that, like David Sanger says?
In my belief, they've paid some attention to it. They've backed some horses to see how they might do, and those horses didn't do very well. I think that one of the things that you need to recognize is that we're in a period now. I've been doing this for 10 years, starting with the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq. Is we started with this period where the U.S. was deeply involved in the Middle East and trying to make changes to governments as they saw fit based on an ideology built around what we call the neocon idea. And that didn't go well. Everyone recognizes that at this point. You know, the U.S. involvement in the Middle East has been a disaster now for a decade. And as a result, they're trying to find a new way. And one of them is hands off. The simple fact is, yes, America would like to see Assad fall. But they're not really willing to be the ones that put al-Qaeda in power. And that's something that they're very afraid of. We always joke about how, you know, well, didn't you sort of start the Taliban in Afghanistan? Well, you know, when you backed the Afghans against the Soviets. And if you talk to a CIA guy, he'll tell you, yeah, that's what happened. We're not going to do that again. You know, so to a certain extent, this is the American government learning some lessons about the limit of their power. And one of them is, if you're looking at al-Qaeda trying to overthrow Bashar Assad and you don't like either, why not just see what plays out and deal with it then? You don't want to necessarily get involved in a knife fight that ugly with this many ugly guys involved.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, I mean, they've already done enough to help in the first place, so it's not quite hands-off, but I understand what you're saying. And believe
well,
no, me, I prefer
on,
this to doubling down.
But in terms of serious stuff, it has. Look, they've given some radios. You know, they've given some body armor, they gave some humanitarian stuff, and they trained like 70 guys and armed them from Jordan that we know about. And these 70 guys went into Syria and probably disappeared. They joined other factions, or who knows, they could be running like falafel shops for all we know. But they just, it just never really took. When that started happening, you saw the American government go, wait a second. You know, who are these people? And the problem that everybody faces is, we've never seen groups like Nusra, Arar al-Sham, and even to a certain extent the Islamic Front before. These guys definitely subscribe to an ideology that on paper, you know, the West is uncomfortable with. But at the same time, they've been relatively focused and haven't been nearly as insane as we've seen, you know, former al-Qaeda-linked groups doing mass kidnappings and beheadings and, you know, random car bombings. You know, most of that stuff in Syria has been done by ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I mean, I'm not saying they haven't done any of it. They've done some.
Yeah, I mean,
so
these are the same guys
hoisting
the black flag over Fallujah right now, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, they're not. That's ISIS. That's not Nusra.
Right.
Although I'm sure Nusra guys in a normal situation would be perfectly happy to go fight in Fallujah against the Shiite government in Maliki. They're doing it in Syria right now. I mean, so again, the difference is small. But no, you don't see them doing that. They're fighting against those guys because they want a revolution for the Syrians. As a result, now we're seeing a lot of confusion on the ground and new groups are forming. One of them is the Islamic Front. Frankly, I think they're ready to work with the Americans, and I think it would be smart to explore if it's possible because they are the largest. They've been fairly responsible. Their guys are reasonably well organized and trained, and they have a command and control that we've never seen before. If they tell a unit to do something, the unit's going to do it. Now that you've established that, you go negotiate with the guy who can give the orders. Whether or not those negotiations would go anywhere, I don't know. But I do think for the American government, it would be smart to have a meeting with those guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a piece of foreign policy where they tried
to. Why would you talk to the Americans? They haven't helped you yet. Why should they get a vote? That's what all the Syrians tell me is, why does Obama get to decide who stays and who goes and what type of rebellion we should have? He doesn't give us any money. He doesn't give us any weapons. He doesn't give us any help. If you want a say in what's going on in Syria, become involved in Syria. So there's a disconnect there. Half of America thinks we're too involved in Syria, and the Syrians think we don't get an opinion because they don't see anything from us.
Hmm. Well, it's funny, though, the way anyone looking critically at this could have told you that, you know, it was jihadists doing suicide bombings from the very beginning of the uprising in Syria.
Well,
and there were reports of Libyan fighters going there right away. And there were, you know, Hillary Clinton said at the time that, hey, you know, I'm an al-Zawahiri and Hamas are backing this uprising. So I'm not so sure, even though we don't like Assad, I'm not so sure we want to back his enemies here. And then it was months later, according to her and her friends' leaks in the New York Times, that she and Petraeus and Panetta tried to get Obama to do just that and to double down on it, and that he refused to go along with their plan. But she seemed to express that they knew good and well that the opposition here are you know, no Thomas Jeffersons, as Colin Powell would say.
No, but the thing is, you're just simply never going to find any Thomas Jeffersons in the Middle East. It's their own culture and it's their own world. They're going to come up with the people that they come up with.
Right.
And it's not going to look like what we do. So, you know, on some level, that's what you have to recognize. If you want to see Bashar gone and you want to have influence with the rebels that took him over, you might have to back somebody who's not entirely somebody you would normally do business with.
Yeah.
That's
well,
why
but
it's
then
hard.
Again,
that's
so,
why,
I mean,
like, come on, but these are decisions that are brutal that the President of the United States has to make, because I can make a strong argument as a journalist who covers it for either course of action.
Well, I set up a straw man about the Jefferson thing. I mean,
one way or another.
You could at least, you got to find somebody who hasn't sworn allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, right? I mean,
well,
is that too much to ask?
Well, that's exactly part of it. Hold on. No, that's exactly part of what we're discovering now. And even so, it's something that we're trying to figure out. What does that mean exactly? So here you've got a group that says they're al-Qaeda, and Zawahiri says, these guys aren't mine, and I wish they would stop. Then you've got a group that's being a reasonably responsible actor on the ground who says, where's our Cowies guys? And he likes them. Then there's another group. He has people who are definitely supportive of a lot of al-Qaeda's agenda who haven't expressed any interest in international jihad and just say we're conservative farm boys who want to overthrow the regime.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the problem is we had a really easy time early on in this, you know, so-called war on terror that got handed to us back in 2001. You know, in terms of determining who were bad guys and who weren't. The problem is there's no such thing as complete bad guys and complete good guys, or they're very, very rare. And determining who is useful and what the cost is what we've done a terrible job of for 10 years. Right now, I see the administration basically abandoning Syria because they can't really tell what will be the good move, and I suppose that's better than them doing something stupid.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael Hayden says it's time to go ahead and switch back to Assad, the former head of the CIA.
Well, you know, and there's a big push for that. There's a big push for that. In fact, I'm increasingly convinced a Western PR company is working with Assad, because the way he's gotten on message in the last 9 months or so is astounding. Like, he speaks like George Bush. So does Hassan Nasrallah. Like, when you hear these guys give speeches now, I covered 2001, 2002 period. I covered the coverage of the passage of the Patriot Act. And these guys are using the exact same garbage rhetoric that we saw from lawmakers back then that allowed us to get stuff like the Patriot Act and the invasion of Iraq without actually thinking about what we were going to do when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are making all the same mistakes.
Let me ask you this real quick, Mitchell.
Level.
How many Western Europeans do you think, I mean, just very vague ballpark numbers, do you think have traveled to Syria to fight with the rebels here? Tens, hundreds?
Ballpark figure based on, I've heard a range of different figures. Western Europeans, give it 1,000 at the high end, definitely more than 500.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm a little low. When you start getting into Eastern Europeans, Bosnians, Chechens, Dagestan, stuff like that, those guys have come in about the same numbers. There's got to be at least 1,000 of those guys.
Right. So that's, you know, looking.
And you start mixing in various dudes from all over the place. You know, a dude from America, three guys from Canada. I think a Canadian guy died today for ISIS. You know, a handful, but the big bulk has come from the Caucasus in Eastern Europe and from Western Europe, you know, families of second-generation immigrants, stuff like that.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned Afghanistan, and it seems like that could be a terrible precedent here for the blowback coming in the future from this battleground, which is, what, 1,500 miles west of Afghanistan, after all, right? Right on the Mediterranean.
Correct.
So, anyway,
American policy.
Go ahead.
American policy towards this stuff often resembles a bunch of guys who just don't want to be responsible for that in 5 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they'll be gone by then. But we won't. All right. Thanks very much. I sure appreciate your time on the show, Mitchell, very much.
No problem. Always a pleasure. Bye.
All right, everybody. That is Mitchell Prothrow reporting from Lebanon for McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. We'll be back with Doug Casey in a minute.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.